Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, local reaction to the U.S.-ordered killing of Iran's most powerful military commander.
It was a strike that was aimed at both disrupting that plot, deterring further aggression. We hope setting the conditions for de-escalation as well.
They've now dramatically escalated tensions with Iran. And are we at risk of going to war? Absolutely.
Plus, we'll take your calls during our week in review on the strike in Iraq, Beacon Hill priorities, and the 2020 presidential race.
If the best Democrats can offer is business as usual after Donald Trump, then Democrats will lose.
And Flower Bakery's Joanne Chang on how to give your pastries some extra love.
There's no better way to connect with people than making something that you love and then sharing it with the people that you love.
It's all coming up on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and all eyes are on the Middle East today after the White House announced it killed Iran's most powerful military commander early Friday morning. Major General Qasem Soleimani led the powerful Quds force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which the U.S. designates as a terrorist organization. He and several others were killed by drone as they were leaving the international airport in Baghdad. Iran has already promised retaliation in the upcoming days. So here to make sense of this with us is Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating. He serves on the House Foreign Affairs and Armed Services Committees. He joins us now on the line. Congressman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Congressman, I just want to start by asking you your reaction to this news.
Well, we knew there was an escalation in the midst that has been occurring over the past several months, and particularly over the last few weeks. And I must admit, I think the killing of General Soleimani took everyone by surprise, except perhaps the people in the close intelligence ring around the president that that made that decision. So that this definitely is an escalation. It's something that there will be retaliation for in terms of military tactics and the person that was killed. Certainly, I don't think there's any American and many other people around the world are going to mourn for the loss of this person who was, in fact, a war criminal. However, you know, the decision has many ramifications, and that's something that beyond the military tactics involved of the moment that are going to cause great challenges and concerns and uncertainty going forward.
Congressman, I want to comb this out a little bit. We're still really in the relatively early hours of these events. So yes. Here's what we think we know. The White House says the president ordered the military strike on Soleimani at the international airport in Baghdad to thwart what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called an imminent threat against American lives. Is there more information that you want to know or see come out in the next hours or days?
Well, absolutely. And that will occur. It'll occur to briefings of members of Congress in general, certainly occur within the Foreign Affairs Committee, and certainly occur in the Armed Services Committee, both of which I'm a member of, so that there'll be, much of that will be classified. Some of it won't be. It's important to let the public know as well everything that they can know, because, indeed, this will have ramifications.
Do you expect the administration to be fully forthcoming with the information you require on your committees?
I think they will, because it'll be the military as well. I found in my experience, particularly in the two committees I serve, the military, as follow-up briefings, will be much more forthright, perhaps, than what the public will be able to get for information. And that usually when questioned, they'll give you a very straightforward response. So, believe me, and the public should be aware of this, there will be questions, and it will be in-depth. Much of that will be classified. However, my concern, too, is regardless of the immediacy of what occurred, and we want to know that. Here's what we want to know about the immediacy. We want to know whether or not that immediacy triggered a legal response, and that's something that's important for Congress and the American public.
When you say immediacy, you mean the imminent threat argument that Mike Pompeo has made.
Exactly. And I'm not questioning it. I believe, as a former district attorney, as a member of Congress, you know, you only know what you know. So we're all anxious to get the facts straight from military sources and from the intelligence community, as well as other people in the administration. But we want to first make sure that was done in a legal context. There's no reason to doubt it at this point. Secondly, however, a concern I've had over the last year or so in particular when it comes to Iran is and the whole Middle East is the lack of an overall policy. And that's something that's going to be questioned as well.
Do you mean an overall sort of strategy for the U.S. with Iran or with the Middle East?
Exactly. You can look at this one instance, and you can look at it in the prism of a military tactic and a response. But just as important to our security is an overall strategy. And whether or not we're bringing the whole power of the government as a whole into play. And here's some of the things we'll be looking at going forward and seeking answers to. And that's going to be, number one, how much consultation has there been with our allies, and particularly Iraq? Iraq's response was to condemn what we'd done. It was done on the sovereign area of Iraq, and that presents basic political problems to them, where there's already been introduced in the Iraq parliament legislation to force us to leave those bases there and leave a very, I think, strategic foothold into the whole Middle East, one that was instrumental in thwarting ISIS. So,
Congressman, do I hear you saying that you're concerned that perhaps there wasn't coherent strategy in place, that this was a tactical strike, but perhaps not a coherent strategy behind it?
Well, I would say this, that over not just this instance, but over the period of last year and maybe particularly in the last few months, at hearings that we've had that were public as well as classified briefings, there's been a concern of an overall policy, a strategy that'll have to be in place. And that strategy has to include making sure our allies, including Iraq, including our NATO allies, including our regional allies, are all with us. One of the greatest strategic advantages we have that makes us effective and also protects our security is the fact that we have something that few of these other competing and dangerous countries have. We have a very strong coalition. That cannot be something can be overlooked. That is of huge strategic importance, and that's been raised time and time again, most recently when we made our move in Syria to withdraw.
So that makes,
and not keeping our allies notice.
That makes me want to ask you, Congressman, what do you think are the sort of critical immediate next steps? Understanding your concern about a coalition and allies, 48, 72 hours, what are the critical next steps for security and to maintain those relationships?
That's a very important question because, in my mind, probably the most immediate concern, number one, is what prior and what ongoing measures have we taken to protect, not just in this region, not just in Iraq and in the Middle East, but around the globe, what's in place to protect Americans, American military, and American civilians around the globe? Now, Iran isn't simply, one country in terms of its influence. They have proxies all over the world. And those proxies have been trained and armed and are dangerous. And one of the things that we might anticipate within retaliation is Iran working through those proxies. I don't want to start detailing the areas of the globe because much of that is classified.
But it does make me want to ask you, are you concerned about safety here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
I'm concerned about the safety worldwide, and that includes the U.S. They are capable of retaliating through proxies and directly, and they will. There's one thing we're sure of with this, I don't think there's anyone that's questioning it. There will be retaliation. What form that will take, how it will come about, I want to know the level of preparedness because we have embassies around the world that aren't, the great fortresses that we had in Iraq, where we saw them get through at least the perimeter there, and there are already proxies in these regions. And so that's one of the things I want to know and question the administration when we get back. What was your preparation ahead of time? what are we doing on an ongoing
I'm
basis?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Congressman.
How safe are we protecting for Americans?
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I just want to, the president is speaking now. We may cut away to that momentarily. In the meantime, what's the most important thing that you think the president needs to say to the American people right now?
I think he wants to make sure that he details why we acted the way we did. I think that will that'll be forthcoming. But what I also want to do, if he can, without putting us in any kind of security risk, detail, as I hope he does with us and should be able to do with us, at least in a classified way, what we're doing to protect Americans around the globe right now.
Congressman Keating, I'm going to ask you to hang on. We're going to go to the president for a minute, and I'd love to, if you can stay on, come back to you.
Should have been done long ago.
Thanks.
A lot of lives would have been saved. Just recently, Soleimani led the brutal repression of protesters in Iran, where more than 1,000 innocent civilians were tortured and killed by their own government. We took action last night to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war. I have deep respect for the Iranian people.
This is Radio Boston. You're listening to live comments from President Donald Trump, fed through Fox News.
We do not seek regime change. However, the Iranian regime's aggression in the region, including the use of proxy fighters to destabilize its neighbors, must end, and it must end now. The future belongs to the people of Iran, those who seek peaceful coexistence and cooperation, not the terrorist warlords who plunder their nation to finance bloodshed abroad. The United States has the best military by far anywhere in the world. We have the best intelligence in the world. If Americans anywhere are threatened, we have all of those targets already fully identified, and I am ready and prepared to take whatever action is necessary. And that in particular refers to Iran. Under my leadership, we have destroyed the ISIS territorial caliphate. And recently, American Special Operations Forces killed the terrorist leader known as al-Baghdadi. The world is a safer place without these monsters. America will always pursue the interests of good people, great souls, while seeking peace, harmony, and friendship with all of the nations of the world. Thank you. God bless you. God bless our great military, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Congressman Keating, do we still have you with us?
Yes, you do.
I sure appreciate you staying with us as we listen to live comments from President Donald Trump stream through Fox News. I'm glad that we have you. Let me just ask you for your reactions to what we just heard.
Well, I think much of what the president said mirrors what we talked in one level. That is that I think we're safer in terms of the immediate impact of General Soleimani, who is a war criminal who, as I mentioned, no American's going to mourn the loss of. I agree with him. We have the best military. I agree with him that we have the best intelligence. I'm concerned, and where I'm going to be asking questions with so many of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, when we're briefed next week, will be what's the next step? Because there are deputies. There are other people in place. Removal of just this malign actor alone doesn't mean that he's got deputies that are following him. They are a military of their own. And our intelligence is great, but their opportunities, as I mentioned, around the world through proxies, is a great challenge to us. And in terms of ISIS, if Iraq is, and this is a great controversy right now in Iraq, if they remove us from their country, which is their right, and we have no choice about, we're there at invitation only, will that open up Iraq again and create a vacuum where ISIS and similar groups can come in? So this is not, as the president described, and I'll agree with him on the instant description. Where I'm concerned, and I think members of Congress, rightfully on both sides of the aisle, are going to be concerned, is what's the next step? What contingencies are you placed? Is this part of an overall policy? Are we going to use the whole power of the U.S. government diplomatically, State Department, sharing of intelligence, economic powers, or are we limiting ourselves? We can't have reactions as the way we did with the Iraqi government and the French government just to our actions of yesterday create schisms. And I think that's going to present problems. So what you heard from the president was a very narrow view of what happened in an immediate event. And what we're concerned about with our overall security, we should be, and we you know, this is something that's not isolated to this one incident, is what is our overall policy? What is our strategy? We cannot shoot from the hip and react to it from instance to instance. If we do that, our overall national security will be in jeopardy. So these are the real questions that are there. And so as I heard the president speak, he was speaking of the narrow instance surrounding this one action and not enough to the overall impact of what's going to occur.
Congressman,
we had a situation.
I'm sorry,
that's my reaction.
Great. Thank you. And I hope you'll come back on in the days to come to talk with us more about how to process these events.
Thank you so much for sharing the information.
Thank you so much. That was Congressman Bill Keating. He represents Massachusetts' 9th District and serves on the House Foreign Affairs and Armed Services Committees. We were lucky to be joined by the congressman and get some unexpected live coverage of the president as well. That leads us into our week in review. It is Friday. We do a week in review. Obviously, we're going to focus on a little bit different subject today to start. So with us here in Studio 3 is Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer, as well as John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Ed, good to have you too.
Well, happy new year.
And you, we'd like you to join the conversation as well. And we want to start by inviting you to react to what you're learning and understanding about these events with Iran. Are you concerned? Are you relieved? Do you think that this makes us more or less safe? What do you want or need to know next as a citizen, given the moment that we're in? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Be a part of the conversation with us. So, John and Ed, we just heard a lot and actually some, you know, some live breaking stuff while we were sitting here. Let me just start by asking you your reactions. John, go ahead.
Well, I think this is reality TV Trump. And, you know, there's a video circulating on Twitter right now of Donald Trump in 2011 predicting that Barack Obama was going to start a war in Iran to help him win re-election. So there's always a video out there.
Are you saying that you think the president is politically motivated in this drone strike?
I would not rule that out. I think that that this is another instance where Donald Trump is completely inconsistent. He says, I like peace, and we're sending 3,500 more troops to the Middle East. We've sent 14,000 since May. You know, this is Donald Trump as America's first Cubist president. He's on every side of every issue. So he wants peace, but he wants to withdraw, but we're going to have 17,000 more troops in the Middle East. So it doesn't add up. And I think looking for kind of a rational explanation for what Donald Trump does is a bit of a fool's errand.
So, and I'm going to pick up on that by giving you some sound from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Fox News this morning. Here's how he described the choice that was before the president as he made this decision about this strike.
What was sitting before us was his travels throughout the region and his efforts to make a significant strike against Americans. There would have been many Muslims killed as well, Iraqis, people in other countries as well. It was a strike that was aimed at both disrupting that plot, deterring further aggression. We hope setting the conditions for de-escalation as well.
So, Ed, I'm just going to put the number out there for our listeners, 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. He's talking there about Soleimani. And you know, John said, we got this Cubist president. He's on all sides of the issue. I want peace. And this is an aggressive act. We hear Pompeo's talking about de-escalation there right after we killed arguably the most powerful military commander in Iran. How does one think about that yin and yang?
Well, I think two things right now. First, I think is that 3 days before Bill Clinton was impeached in, what was it, 1998, I think it was, he launched an unprovoked bombing of Iraq 3 days before the House impeachment vote. I remember how odd it was that he suddenly decided to bomb Saddam Hussein when nothing had happened recently. The other thing I think about is how a couple of months ago, the Washington Post had found a treasure trove of documents showing that our government has been consistently lying to us about the state of the war in Afghanistan for all these years. So I really don't trust any of these people to tell me what's going on in the Middle East at all.
So, you know, it's interesting, and you might both call me naive for this, because when we were thinking about this segment earlier today, I argued, we won't go to the politics of this first. We'll really stay sort of in the national security. Are people safe? Are we going to go to war? You both went straight to the politics of it. Is there a way, and is it useful to think about just the security piece first? And is there a way we need to process that? Or are you arguing that we can't extract this from politics?
I don't think Donald Trump takes into account national security issues. He doesn't listen to his advisors. He doesn't listen to the intelligence community. He doesn't listen to the State Department. Mike Pompeo doesn't listen to the State Department. So to think about this in terms of Donald Trump has a strategy to do this, to increase our national security, I think is it doesn't jive with the facts. I think that that this is something that he's doing because this is what he does. He does the thing in front of him that's going to, he thinks, benefit him the most.
Do you agree with that?
Yes. I am waiting to hear from other voices about what this means and what our security is. One thing we learned from the impeachment hearings is that there are a lot of great Americans who are serving in our government in all different capacities, who love this country, who are smart, and who are informed. I'm looking for other voices to step up and explain to us what is happening and what it means, and I will listen to those voices.
So we've got callers just coming through the lines quickly, so let's turn to them. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Payman from Beverly on the line. What's on your mind, Payman?
Well, I'd like to touch on the fact that General Soleimani was one of the champions of fighting ISIS in Syria, fighting ISIS in Iraq. He actually coordinated with the United States military in Afghanistan to fight bin Laden. He coordinated with the United States military to fight ISIS in Mosul, to liberate Mosul. And it's incredible that some of the people have the brass neck to call this man so evil when he was on the front lines fighting Takfiri elements.
Payman, I appreciate that. You know, I've gone back and done quite a bit of reading just in the last few hours about Soleimani. We did coordinate with Iran in the fighting of ISIS, but there's also a great deal of evidence that he was behind killing of American soldiers in the mid-aughts, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008. What I take from your call and what you're saying there is that, as is so often the case with foreign policy in the Middle East, this is complicated. And do we understand what we need to understand? You know, Ed just said, John, hey, there are some people I need to hear from before I know how to process this. What do we need to know?
Well, we need to know a whole lot of other information about who brought this to Donald Trump. Somebody, it would seem to be logical that somebody brought it to Donald Trump and pitched it to him, because it just comes out of the blue. This could have been done many times. Why now?
Well, in fact, we chose not to do it over the summer, right?
Right. So why now? So that's one thing. And the other thing is, I understand that Soleimani, collaborated with the U.S. In fighting ISIS. And you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But in this case, the enemy of my enemy can still be my enemy. Because when you look at the ledger, you know, on one side of the ledger is an awful lot of damage to America and to the Middle East.
Well,
and on the other side, you've got this one thing. So I don't think they quite balance out.
Yeah, Soleimani was the head of CUDS, the CUDS force, which was part of what we designate as a terrorist organization. I want to take another call, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. I was just trying to talk about what you were talking to the congressman about. He seemed, and I understand why on one level he wanted, he seemed like he was overly concerned about security here. He kept talking about that. I'm not any more scared today as I was yesterday or 3 weeks ago.
Why, Dave?
So it's just the world we live in. It's not a pleasant time for a lot of things, and it's just one of those things. And by the way, I still can't make any judgments because I just don't know enough about what happened in the actual incident. I'd like to know how it happened, why it happened, and, you know, the actual mechanics of it, so I can make my own judgment as to whether or not we did the right thing or not.
Thanks, Dave, for that. And I'm going to take that to Ed. You know, one of the things that we're hearing, you said it, Ed, Dave just said it, this is a time when we need information. So how do we proceed feeling confident that we're getting the quality information that's available? And where's the accountability to make sure that that happens so that the American people can process this as citizens?
I don't know. We should have better information, but I don't believe that information is going to lead us to a policy that is good for the long-term interests of America. You know, when I was much younger, I really thought that the sins of our enemies could justify American policy. The benefit of age and maturity is that you realize that's not enough, that there are many enemies of America who deserve death, and maybe even from us, but there are consequences to just hunting down and killing bad guys in a complicated world, and I'm not sure information is going to help us. I'm sure we'll find out this was a very bad man and all that,
so,
but
Ed,
I want something else.
Us? What will help us?
What will help us is to have a leadership in our government that is explaining to people what their real choices are in the world and have them vote appropriately for how they want America to interact with the world. And I think that's really, really hard. You have a president who is not capable of presenting those choices. And to be honest, I don't think President Obama did a great job in presenting these choices to the country either. We need different leaders who will be able to absorb all of this, tell us what we can and can't do, and try to do the right thing. It won't be about how bad this man was.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pedro is on the line from Wellesley. Pedro, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Real quick, I'm worried about you mentioned misinformation, and you had mentioned politics in the previous caller. I'm worried because we have a person in the White House currently, which misinformation is his, you know, oh my goodness, it's what he excels in, never telling us the truth. So how do we get this information? The other thing I'm worried about is we have this bull in a china shop in this very finely crafted chess game. Oh my goodness, am I worried to death about this?
All right, thanks for that, Pedro. Let me turn to John for response.
Well, there's no guarantee that we're going to get information from this administration. There's no guarantee that Donald Trump is going to allow Mike Pompeo to go to Capitol Hill and testify even behind closed doors, because he's going to say, well, it's going to be leaked and it's going to be misinterpreted and it's going to be twisted and weaponized.
Well, some of it might be leaked.
Some of it might be leaked, but don't be surprised if nobody goes and gives any of this information that people rightly have a right to know. Don't be surprised if it doesn't happen, because Mike Pompeo talked to the foreign minister of Russia before he talked to Congress. Expecting the usual kinds of processes and government accountability that used to be the norm, expecting that now, I think, is again, you know, I think you're overestimating the faith that Donald Trump has in the American process.
Let's grab another call. We've got Pat on the line from Watertown. Pat, what's on your mind?
I'm concerned. I can see, you know, and again, we don't have enough information. I can see why Donald Trump would think this has a positive endgame for him and how it could help him get reelected. But I fail to see how anything positive is going to come out of this for America, because haven't we sung the song before, first with Afghanistan and then with Iraq?
So let me turn that to Ed. Let me ask Ed what he thinks.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, again, and this is how it's so different for me as a middle-aged man. I was saying I've lived through these wars in the Middle East and misinformation and lies and false promises and process and all these obfuscations of what we were doing. John tells me in the green room that he remembers Vietnam and similar things. I just think...
Thanks for aging me, Ed.
Well, you're not that much older than I am, and you're just a little bit wiser. And so I do think that we have to ask ourselves, just after so many problems in the Middle East for so many years and trillions of dollars and all the ruined lives here and abroad, you know, we can't approach this as if it's a new problem with a blank slate. We have to look at what we've done, what our leaders have told us, why they have lied to us, what the forces are, and take a long, deep breath and think about what we want to do over there.
All right. So I think this is a time to turn to politics in 2020. And here's why. Ed, really, Ed, you talked about we need a different kind of leader. You weren't particularly pleased with how President Trump has made a case for foreign policy. You weren't pleased with how President Obama has made a case for foreign policy. We just entered 3 days ago an election year when we've got a number of people vying to be the next president of the United States. John, how much do the events of the last 24 hours figure into the calculus of what messages people should be delivering, whether it's the incumbent or the challengers right now, around being the next leader of this country?
Well, it's extremely fraught. Elizabeth Warren found out how quickly the left reacts to sort of wishy-washy Twitter statements and backed off immediately and called it an assassination. You know, I mean, this is volatile enough and there is enough uncertainty in this field that that people are going to have to really try to figure out, you know, what do I want to stand for and what do I want to stand by? Because Elizabeth Warren flunked the early test. I think that a lot of pressure is going to be put on these candidates to take particular positions. And this is going to be – we're going to see the difference between – the universe of Twitter and the universe of the real world. And I think that Elizabeth Warren, stumbled on this one right out of the gate.
So listeners, join this conversation. Will these events affect your calculus in who your candidate is? Will you look for something different or have you made up your mind already and there's nothing in this that changes that? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. Ed, much of the conversation, at least on the Democratic side, you know, the debates that we've covered here on Radio Boston, et cetera, really has not been foreign policy focused. And many of the leading candidates are much more economic policy, social justice policy. What kinds of foreign policy chops is necessary for a president who will be inheriting or continuing, in the case if Donald Trump wins, a country that's in this security situation?
If you look at the decisions of our government over the past 25 or 30 or 50 years, I don't think there's any relationship between good policy and the foreign policy chops of the people that are involved. I mean, World War I was started by a bunch of men who were extraordinarily educated about history and the military, and look what happened. What we need to have is people who can, as I said earlier, to look at the world as it is, acknowledge all our involvement and all of our investment and all these problems in the world and explain to the public what are the trade-offs, different levels of involvement. I don't really believe that within the next few days the Democratic candidates are going to be able to suddenly care about the Middle East in a way that is compelling and wins them a lot of Twitter retweets. What we really need is for some sobriety. We need them to just sit down and say, boy, what do I think about the world? What happens if things change dramatically in the Middle East? And what am I going to tell the people honestly about it? What will endure over the next few months rather than just win the news cycle? President Trump, I suppose, has to do the same thing, try to figure out that when he's presenting his case for reelection, how does he explain the security of the world and what he and his administration have done to make it better or worse rather than just go for the headline? We've had too much of that.
Let me take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barb's on the line from Cape Cod. Barb, what's on your mind?
Hi. I'd just like to ask John, as a listener to him for many years and as an extreme skeptic, would he think that this whole Iran assassination is a ruse from impeachment?
All right. Off the air. Thanks, Barb.
Well, Donald Trump is certainly one of the great distraction machines of all time. And this has been going on now for 3 years. And when things get difficult for him, he tends to throw some bright, shiny object up. This one's a little brighter and shinier than usual. But I don't want to be cynical about this, but I don't have much choice. And I think that, you know, Donald Trump's motives are always suspect because Donald Trump is a transactional president. You know, what he wants to do is do things that work to his advantage. He has no principles, really. He has no standards. He has context. You know, he has what's happening in this moment. So if you ask me, was this a smart move? I'm not a Middle East expert. I can't say. You know, will it have terrible consequences? Very possibly. Does Donald Trump actually know what he's doing?
You don't sound like you think so.
I don't know.
So, Ed, you know, it is inescapable that this is happening. Whether this has to do with impeachment, it is inescapable that it is happening in the context of impeachment. And in fact, an impeachment that is in and of itself in limbo. Nancy Pelosi and the House are holding on to the articles of impeachment, haven't delivered them yet to the Senate. We've got at least one scholar, one who testified before Congress, Noah Feldman, arguing that means he hasn't even been impeached yet. Mitch McConnell saying, hey, we are going to stick with what I already said. We're not going to take witnesses right away. We'll do that partway through. Fair is fair. Does a moment like this, where existential safety seems to be at risk, call for a different approach from Congress with this other moment that we're in?
Not really. I think Congress needs to do what it thinks is right. I think it would be right for Congress to investigate this no matter what was happening. As I said, Bill Clinton inexplicably bombed Iraq 3 days before his House vote, and nobody could really tell why he did it at that point. Impeachment affects everything we do here, and it affects our enemies. You know, our enemies say, oh, America is very divided and vulnerable right now. Maybe now would be a good time to advance our agenda. We conduct foreign policy based on the situation in the governments around the world. They do the same thing with us. This will affect both sides of this, and both sides have to figure out how they can marshal their strengths despite that. So I do think that America needs to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to deal with the impeachment issue while we're being a responsible government. That's not easy, but let's hope they do that.
John.
Yeah, just one thing about what Congressman Keating said. He asked, you know, did Donald Trump consult with our allies? That's a really important question. And because this is going to affect our allies all over the world, but especially in the Middle East. And it would have been nice if he did. I hope he did. But I wonder whether that – it doesn't seem like his style. And so you've got all these things piling one on top of the other. Let me just add one thing about the politics of it.
Pile it on, John.
The politics of it, I mean, in raw political terms, this helps Joe Biden immensely.
How come?
Because Joe Biden has been on the world stage. If you're looking for somebody who knows something about foreign policy and you agree with them or not agree with them, doesn't matter. If you're looking for somebody who is seasoned to some degree in foreign policy, Joe Biden is really the only one in that field.
So it's interesting. I don't have time to take another call, but we have a caller waiting who wanted to say that she thinks this favors Pete Buttigieg because he served in the armed services. John, you don't seem to agree with that.
I don't think so. I mean, he did serve in the armed services, and you know, that's terrific. But I don't think that gives you foreign policy chops necessarily. That gives you experience.
What do you think, Ed?
I think that the people that want us to start over in the Middle East, he would be attractive. But I think the majority of people will be worried about the consequences and the wisdom needed to be able to process all of this, and they'll want someone like Vice President Biden.
All right. So we don't have a ton of time left, just a couple of minutes. And I really do want to turn our attention more locally for just a minute. You know, now that we're into 2020, we're into a new legislative season. A bunch of new laws kicked in on New Year's, or they're going to kick in the coming weeks. Minimum wage rose 75 cents an hour to $12.75. State's income tax fell to 5%. Finally, flavored vaping products are being banned. Automatic voter registration in effect. There's a bunch of things. 7 months left in this session. There's a lot on the table for lawmakers. What do you guys see as the top priorities, Ed?
Well, first, I'd like to say that I'm proud of the fact that our state politics seem to be working very well, that we can solve problems here. We're the envy of the nation in terms of our bipartisanship and our productivity, despite all things we need. I think we should take a moment and be proud of that, while Washington is burning, we're solving problems. I think that's great. I would like to see a few things this coming year. I'd like to see us, handle climate issues. I'd like to see us handle some of the structural deficit problems we have in our government. I'd like to see us advance much further on transportation. And there's a bunch of other things. But I'm really happy with what we accomplished last year.
All right. How about you, John?
I would like to see some progress on the MBTA. I think that it's a gaping hole in Charlie Baker's record that he has. And it's a daunting test. There's no question about it. But the fact that he basically banked his governorship on fixing the MBTA and the increasingly difficult time they're having just running the system, never mind extending it. I would like to see that happen because that has all kinds of economic fallout and all kinds of economic ripples that come out of that. So to me, I'd like to see all the things that Ed said and
plus
that,
one.
Plus one, right.
All right. That's John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and the man behind the blog It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Also with us, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, and listeners, before we break, I want to let you know, join us Tuesday night here on WBUR at 7 for a special edition of Radio Boston, where we're going to cover Mayor Walsh's State of the City address. That's Tuesday night at 7 on 90.9 WBUR. Meanwhile, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Do you know that feeling? You walk into a bakery and you get that smell. There's butter, there's sugar. If you're me, you want chocolate. And you see that display of pastries and it's beautiful and it's bountiful. And you're like, oh, I want them all. which one do I choose? That's because of Joanne Chang, basically. Renowned chef Joanne Chang has coined a term for that feeling. She calls it pastry love, and it's a guiding philosophy at her bakeries, which are called Flower. But pastry love is also the title of her latest book, which she calls a baker's journal of favorite recipes. And you really can kind of bury yourself inside this book and the joy of baking. She joins us here in Studio 3 to tell us more about it. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
This is such a welcome subject after a long and challenging week. Why do we love pastries so much? Why do you love pastries so much?
Gosh, I could talk all day about why I love pastries so much. For me, honestly, it started out when I was little and I had my first bite of something sweet and just the amount of joy, just sheer joy that I got from it. It automatically makes me smile. Like you just described, it smells great. When I walk into the bakeries, that pastry love, that whole sensation of walking in and just being overwhelmed by the beauty and the smell, and I can't wait to dig in. It just brings a lot of joy. And for me, you know, being able to focus and just kind of look at something that's delicious and taste it and enjoy it really gives you a sense of what's really important in life. You know?
So I was interested to discover that pastry love was actually sort of a strategy of yours.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us about that.
Well, when we had one bakery, I literally stood over the counter for 12 hours a day and looked at everything to make sure that it was as perfect as could be. And then as soon as we opened a second location, I could no longer be in two places at once. And so I would call over to the other location and say, have you given the pastry some love? Have you made everything look wonderful? Is everything baked perfectly? And just we shortened it into doing P-Love. Have you done pastry love? Is P-Love done? And so it's grown into a philosophy that all of the bakers and all of the entire Flower team is aware of.
You have 8 locations for Flower now. Do you still make phone calls and ask if people have done pastry love?
Well, now what happens is they take pictures and they send it to us. And so I see the pictures every evening and I get to look to see if pastry love is looking as beautiful as can be.
And when it doesn't, what little kinds of tweaks do you make to make pastries look more beautiful?
You know, a lot of it is just how we arrange them on the counter. And when you're baking, a lot of it is stopping and looking at every single pastry individually. I think it can be easy to look at the whole swath of pastries and think, okay, everything looks great. But you really need to stop and look individually at every pastry because every pastry is going to be enjoyed individually. You know, the whole tray of cookies might look good, but if there's one burnt cookie, if you get that cookie, you're going to be really bummed out.
Yeah, that's true. I don't really love burnt cookies very much. All right, so the book is charming. The introduction
Thank
is charming.
You.
The recipes, each recipe sort of has a story and a setup for it so you know how to engage with it. You talk about this sort of being like a journal. And in fact, one point you give this image of you kind of want this to be the cookbook somebody leaves out on their counter
yes.
and it's splattered by ingredients over the years. So what that suggests to me that special things made it into this book.
Yes.
So how did you decide which pastries go into this book, into Pastry Love?
Well, that was kind of a year-long process of looking through all of my baking journals, looking through all of the recipes that I've played around with it in the past. I've written some other books, so a lot of those recipes are in those books. But honestly, pastry is always evolving. So there are recipes that started off and they might be in one book, and then over the years, I've tweaked them and improved them. A lot of recipes come from my travels. A lot of recipes came from my team. I have pastry chefs and bakers who contributed recipes, and it was really fun for me to be able to share all of those recipes in this book. And so it really is, you know, I want it to be kind of dog-eared and tattered on your kitchen counter in the same way that my own journal is. You know, it's something that I use all the time, and I want other people to be able to use this book in that same way.
You know, the book, I felt invited by it. And then I got into these pages of equipment and master techniques. And there were like 5 pages on equipment and 10 pages on master techniques. So while I wanted to try many of the things in there, I was then also terrified, like, oh, I'm just never going to be able to do that. So how does one begin to make pastry baking accessible to the person who wants a little mindfulness of, or zen in their lives and wants to be in the kitchen doing this is part of how they create that magic.
Yeah, I think you should look at the book not as a Bible. In fact, originally my editor said you should write a pastry Bible, and I said, oh, no, that's way too formal. My journal is just this tattered old thing, and I kind of want to just be very informal and to teach people. So if it's something that you want to approach and you don't have a lot of experience, then just find the pages that speak to you. It's not meant to be something that you have to do, that you have to study and approach, you know, beginning to end. You can take the easier recipes, which are at the beginning of each chapter, and approach them that way. And the master techniques and the equipment sections, again, you don't have to buy all of that equipment. Not all of those techniques will be necessary if you're a beginning baker. But just skimming through all of that and finding the stuff that appeals to you, that's how I want you to approach this book, to make the book yours.
All right. So you brought some treats for us, and we'll get to them in just a minute. But before we do, there's one other thing I want to ask you about before we start talking about specific recipes. Several years ago, I saw you on a panel somewhere. I was sitting in the audience, and they asked you some question about, you know, what makes everything so great in flour. And you just said the word butter. You just said
it's true.
Butter. And that's always stuck with me. And butter plays a big role in this book. But the other thing that was really kind of funny about it was there's a lot of science and chemistry about butter and other ingredients. So how important is sort of the science and chemistry? We think of it as art and delicious. Science and chemistry are kind of hardcore.
They are, and especially with baking. If you look at the basic ingredients or building blocks of baking, it's really a handful of ingredients. It's flour, sugar, butter, eggs, chocolate, like you said earlier. But then it's taking all of these ingredients and putting them together in different proportions, different techniques, and then you can come up with all of these desserts that we're about to try. They all have the same basic ingredients, but we've made four or five different desserts. So the chemistry is super important so that you can get different textures, different flavors. And honestly, it's the fun part. It's that you can open up your cabinet and find these five or six ingredients and then create all of these different desserts.
Yeah, I might argue that the butter is actually the fun part. All right, so you brought a few things for us to try.
Yes.
My listeners can't see. I have actually been holding a fork throughout the entire interview, so you can tell that I am excited. What is the first thing you want us to try?
Let's start with the eggnog cheesecake.
All right.
With the little gingerbread person. So this is a creamy, tangy cheesecake that's made with a lot of nutmeg. And we actually make the gingerbread crust by making a gingerbread cookie and then grinding up half of the cookie to make the crust and then cutting out the little gingerbread men. And then we dust the whole thing with a little bit of nutmeg.
Now, are you going to take a bite too? Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a bite. You first.
Mm. I love this cheesecake because it's not super sweet. It's not super spicy. And it very much tastes like the holidays.
Mm. So it's got, it's the texture, right? It's not heavy. It's not a slab, right?
It's not dense.
No.
It's light and ethereal and creamy, a little bit tangy.
There's not too much ginger.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
Delicious. Excellent. So when would somebody make something like this cheesecake?
This is great for the holidays. Honestly, this is something that we offered on our Christmas menu. I think anytime in the fall or winter, when you're looking at those warming spices, this is a great great dessert option.
And is it an easier one for someone to make?
This is very easy. Honestly, this the tricky thing, which isn't even tricky, it's just if you're not an experienced baker, you might be not sure how to bake something in a water bath, but ideally, you bake this in a water bath, which means you take the cheesecake and you actually put it in a bath of water. You put the cheesecake pan in a bigger pan that has water in it, and it protects the cheesecake so it doesn't overbake.
I'm tasting my fork while telling us this. All right, so what else you got? Everything looks so fabulous.
The next one, if we go to the lemon, this is what we call simple lemon spiral.
It's beautiful.
It's got a sponge cake.
Yes.
Filled with a lemon cream and then coated with lemon curd. And this recipe is really special to me because I actually made this recipe when I interviewed for my first pastry chef job at Rialto Restaurant with Jody Adams and Christopher Myers. Christopher, who's now my husband.
Who's now your husband. And you actually talk about your crush.
Oh, yeah.
In the cookbook.
I do.
It was endearing.
Well, I had a very, very long crush on Christopher. And this was the first thing I ever made him. I mean, I made it for both Jody and Christopher for my interview. But it's just a simple, very, very light sponge cake. It's just the proportions are all right. The lemon is nice and lemony without being overwhelming.
It is. When I tasted it, you get the tart of the lemon right away, but it's not offensive. And actually, the whole thing is so light. It's like it's made out of air.
Right.
But you get this creamy sweet, and you get the sharpness of the lemon. It's fabulous. Now, it looks hard because there's the whole rolling thing.
I think, this sponge cake is very, it's very forgiving. And so
I like that.
Yeah. It's called sponge cake because it's like a sponge. And so once you make it and soak it with the lemon syrup, you can really manipulate it really easily. You can like wave it up and down. So you just spread it with the cream and then you can just roll it
right up.
Super, super easy.
All right. We've got time for one more. We've got about a minute left.
Okay.
So what else are we going
to try? Let's try the double chocolate cookie. This is one of the cookies that I eat almost every day.
You eat a cookie every day.
I do.
I like your life.
It's a double chocolate rye cookie. It's made with rye flour instead of all-purpose flour. It's got big chunks of chocolate and walnuts in it.
So did you make it without the walnuts?
Yes, absolutely. You can just omit the walnuts if you have a nut allergy.
It's got a really strong chocolate flavor, but without being cloying.
Mm-hmm. We call it brownie cookie.
This is like breakfast time, lunch time, dinner time? When do you eat this?
I mean, I eat it breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but I think typically it would be like an afternoon snack.
Excellent. I'm a big fan of cookies for breakfast, but I know that that's going to appall somebody. So, Joanne Chang, chef, owner of Flour and Myers and Chang. Her new book is Pastry Love, A Baker's Journal of Favorite Recipes. It's lovely. And you're
Thank
lovely.
You.
Thank you so much for
Thank
joining
you.
Us again.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. I'm full of cookie. And join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.